And the Oscar for Best Picture is presented to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And the...
Oh, mais que formidable, The Artist!
Perfect! Beautiful. Can you give me just one more?
With pleasure.
Welcome, and thank you for listening. I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
And this is And the Award Goes To, a podcast that breaks down each Best Picture winner from this century's Academy Awards. Last time, Zach and I stepped up to the microphone for the King speech. This time, we turn off the microphones in this almost silent film, The Artist, the 84th Best Picture winner. Zach, not a ton of black and white films this day and age. So what are some of your favorite films shot in that fashion?
I'm going to go super recent for you, Luke, a movie I recommended, The Lighthouse, Robert Eggers. It's his second movie, William Dafoe, Robert Pattinson, black and white horror film. It's brilliant. It's creepy. It's everything you'd want out of a black and white horror film, I will say. I highly recommend it. It's on Amazon Prime. Schindler's List, a movie you recommended to me that I finally watched during quarantine as well. Loved it. I mean, it's brutal. It's a rough watch, but it's probably Spielberg's best movie, I would say. Frances Ha, it's on Netflix, and it's a Noah Baumbach, Greta Gerwig collab where she stars in it, he directed, and they wrote it together, and it's excellent. I really like it. If you're a fan of his type of films, the not so much Marriage Story vibe, but that type of humor. And then A Streetcar Named Desire, I've got to mention that movie. Vivian Leigh and Marlon Brando. It's one of my favorite Brando performances. She's excellent as well. Just great movie of a classic play. And then Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush. As far as silent films go, since we're talking about The Artist, I think that's as good as it gets. What about you?
You had a couple that I would have thought of or kind of thought of. Streetcar / On the Waterfront, both are really good ones.
Absolutely.
I stuck with Schindler's List. One that I love, and maybe it's because I've shown it so many years because of teaching business law, but I love 12 Angry Men, the original version with Peter Fonda. It's a Wonderful Life. It's my favorite Christmas movie, probably. I love Psycho. It's like, I never saw a movie before where the main character or like the biggest star is dead so quickly, or who you thought's the biggest star. Just a classic Hitchcock device. Casablanca. And then to add in a Chaplin, I went with The Great Dictator. I think for a man who was a Jewish American to do that like role of basically satirizing Hitler was amazing without actually doing all the speaking of Hitler, just his movements. That's a really good one.
Your list is perfect for all the classics, so I really appreciate that you represented those well, very well.
And I promise, The Lighthouse is on my list, of ASAP movies to watch.
You'll like it. It's in your wheelhouse.
Reflections and big takeaways for our listeners. This is the first time, and I believe the only time this will occur. Zach and I had not seen this movie until this pod. I'm going to let Zach open us up with his thoughts.
Put me on the spot. Okay. Well, to lead off, you know, this is a movie, Luke, that I questioned back in February of 2012 when it won. And, you know, after watching it finally for this pod, as you said, I'm a little even more baffled by this winning over films like even Chicago, King's Speech, and Crash from previous pods. And, you know, I got my education in silent films in Frank Scheid's film lecture class, which we talked about a little bit there at the U of A. And Scheid did me the great benefit of showing me Charlie Chaplin's greatest silent films like The Gold Rush, and The Kid. And when you apply the Chaplin gold standard to silent films, and then you fast forward to 2011 with The Artist's Attempt, you know, you come away with a movie full of talented actors, don't get me wrong, but for me, they're really failing to capture that Chaplin magic of acting purely on expression and emotion. And sure, Desjardins, Goodman, Cromwell, Bejo, they display plenty of emotion and expressions throughout the movie, but I just don't think their performances are really worthy of that Chaplin precedent he set for silent film acting. And you know, the plot, I'm going to admit, I really think it's intriguing. It's actually has all the makings of a great movie if it had actual dialogue. I think if they had let them keep their lines in, you get a great black and white movie about the silent film era and a silent film star and a romance, essentially. And it could have been special. But when we get into the competition and the snubs, you know, you're going to see this is, I think you'll agree, this is a weak year for film. But, I mean, Crowning the Artist as another Weinstein-backed Best Picture winner, to me, it's another embarrassment for the Academy and its voters that I don't think has aged well.
Yeah, the aging well. Yeah, like I said, first one in the history of this podcast where I have not watched this movie until about 4 days ago. And for all intents and purposes to our listeners, took me about 3 days to watch it. I couldn't put enough time and focus into all 100 minutes of it consecutively. So I kind of broke it up, which is very unlike any other movie experience I usually do. I knew what it was about, obviously, over the years after hearing reading different articles about it. And back then, I definitely just didn't have real interest in watching it. It didn't have anyone really that I knew. I mean, obviously I know John Goodman and Cromwell, but neither of the two leads, the director, no one in. And I was like, well, this, I don't know if I'm interested in going to see that. That said, there, when you watch the whole thing and some of the shots I'm going to talk about that when they get into certain scenes, cause it's shot pretty lovely. It's supposed to be, it's everything that, you know, this bygone era with, Schindler's List was black and white. There's a lot of great black and white movies, but in terms of going for something this style, it's really hard to captivate it when it hasn't really been around since like the mid 20s. When it comes to acting, I'm on the other end of the spectrum for you. Cause in the same token, Shied also showed us some Buster Keaton stuff, who was another famous actor from that time. And I remember because I had a paper I wrote where I quoted Keaton. And there's also, I have a quote that I pulled from Cary Grant. And what Buster Keaton had to say in regards to silent film acting was that essentially the whole purpose, or what a good silent actor does, is they have the gestures of what he called the visual man. And they're not intended to convey concepts which can be expressed in words, but such inner experiences, such non-rational emotions, which still remain unexpressed when everything that can be told has been told. So essentially he wraps it up to say that you're trying to impact something on the viewer that maybe you couldn't get out of them with just words. And for me, in my personal experience, like when he goes through his, basically what I call his downfall, when he's just burning down his apartment and he's thinking of committing suicide, or when he drinks himself till he passes out at this bar, like he's looking at a reflection of himself and he throws water, the disgust that he has of what he's become, I thought Desjardins was remarkable in that regard. I will say as far as physicality goes, no, he wasn't anywhere near Chaplin. That was Chaplin's biggest thing. Just like, I mean, when he eats the shoe and, you know, Gold Rush, like that's a very physical thing. And a lot of his movements he doesn't do as well of a job in that regard. But I think as far as like the expression and the emotional response he elicited, or for me anyway, I enjoyed it. And I thought that was one of the great parts for me, is that like when he goes through his bad parts of his life, yeah, I could feel it. And I was like, I felt for him. And without him and the female lead ever saying a word. When you get to the end where he basically, you can see he loves her and she loves him. It's great chemistry without ever actually hearing them say it. Now I'm with you. Wowzers. Can you imagine a scenario where you had dialogue for all of these scenes? Like, this is a 100-minute movie with 10 lines of dialogue. Can you imagine a reality where we got to hear everything? People can't consume 100 minutes of this. Quibi is a platform out because people can't even watch 30 minutes of something. It chunks it into 10. Like, I love when people try to take risks with film and try to do something original. Like, that's great, but man, I'll get to it later. The film makes its own point, and I just think that this is an era that there's a reason we transitioned out of it. Nothing against, that was the original thing of film, but shout out to our state of Arkansas for inventing the possibility for sound in movies.
I did not know that. That's a great fact. Yeah. I do just want to point out, a lot of what you're complimenting is the plot. And I'm with you. The plot is fantastic in this movie, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head with, if dialogue, if it had been a traditional, like I said, a traditional black and white film with, you know, insert the dialogue, it's a 1920s period piece, I think it still is a Best Picture nominee and gets plenty of accolades.
Yeah,
I really do. Because the plot's fantastic. It's just, and I do think there's great actors and actresses in this. And he's good in a lot of sequences. It's just, I was spoiled on Chaplin. And I do remember Buster Keaton as well. He was great too from that class. But yeah, I was just spoiled on Chaplin is what it comes down to.
I think with Desjardins, like, he's like our guy Castle in the fact that he doesn't really leave France. And I guess he's really known over there for all his different roles. So I would have liked a version of this where we got, and Cromwell says they all deliver the lines of dialogue they're saying out loud. They didn't just mouth it. So there's a cut somewhere out there where we get to hear them all. It's just, it's just that Weinstein theory once again, right?
It's coming back into play, but like I said, thank God that's done with. We don't have to worry about that anymore.
Phased out. Attention to details, where we're going to briefly discuss director, writer, cast, cinematographer. We will get into box office and nominations and wins. So it gets 10 nominations. Second to Hugo, that had 11. It wins 5, man. It wins Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Original Score, Best Costume Design. I think the last two, I'm with on that.
Last two are well-deserved.
But it doesn't win the most for the year. It ties Hugo for the most wins. First black and white film to win since Schindler's List. And how about our boy Christopher Plummer, oldest actor ever to win an Oscar in acting?
For Beginners, Mike Mills film. Mike Mills is the 20th Century Women director I mentioned to you previous pod. Yeah, that's great for Christopher Plummer. I love Mike Mills. So, and then you say you have here Meryl Streep wins her third for The Iron Lady, I believe.
Yep.
It's Margaret Thatcher. Yeah.
Well, gotta love anyone who plays those British roles, man. Hey, Thatcher, Churchill. Meryl Streep.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not hating. I'm just going to say Meryl Streep, you know, most noms of any actor or actress in the history of the Academy, 3 wins as well. She won for roles, though. If you look at the roles she won for and then compare them to some of her noms, it's like, why did you win for these? And you know, basically her best performances are her noms that she didn't win for, is my point.
Is she up to like 20? She in the 20? What is it?
It's like 21 to 23.
Golly.
Yeah.
Insane.
I know.
Voter fatigue, man. Voter
fatigue. Hey, right. And this was the, like, okay, she needs 3.
Yeah, this to put her over the top. This movie, The Artist, released November 25th of 2011 for a limited release so they could get it into award season, and then released worldwide January 20th of 2012. Domestically, It brings in $44 million, 71st for 2011 releases. That's not shocking to me that a lot of people didn't flop. I mean, this, who would pay to sit to, I mean, in 2012, I'm shocked that it made $44 million.
As am I, but you know, it had a buzz at Cannes. I read at Cannes. So, internationally though,
yeah, I was gonna say 133 million worldwide. So once again, another movie where internationally it had a huge, I wouldn't say huge, but it had a following. The budget, though, man, budget of $15 million.
That is impressive to me, but because I would think. Black and one, all the actors would have had to taken low salaries, at least the big name ones. And two, from what I've heard, black and white film stock, if you do it that way, if you shoot on film, it's pretty expensive. So I wonder if they shot on film and did that, or if they shot digitally and then just did it in post.
I would have to think they did like Good Night and Good Luck and shot in color and did the grayscale transformation. Yep. I don't know. Director and writer Michael Hazanavicius. Sorry if I butcher that name. A French man. This would be the only feature film that I've seen that he's put on this side of the world. I don't have a lot of notes on him in that regard. He's never created or written in any other movie that's gone on to be put on, you know, this side of the world, like I just said. So you have any notes on him you'd want to share?
Nothing, because this is the only movie I've ever seen from him. He came out of nowhere and did this. So
right, he's written 16 different films. There's OSS 117, which is, I think, is like a James Bond type series where Desjardins plays the lead role. So I guess this is where they got some of their tie in together. But like I just said, yeah, nothing on this side of the earth, and nothing would go on even planned in production. Cinematographer, we have any notes for him? And he's also a
I'll try his name. Oh man,
give it a shot, first, man.
The first one's killing me. Guillaume Schiffman, he's French as well. Guillaume, yes. I don't know. Yes, French as well. He's collaborated with this Michael, the director, a ton. So they obviously have that relationship, and that's mainly French films. I don't know any of his work beyond this. It's all French films.
Yeah, but he's nominated. I will say for French film, for their big film festival or big award ceremony they do, he's been nominated for best cinematographer three times. So he is known over there. But I mean, not like we just said, most of his films have been French drama films, and he has worked with our director on numerous occasions, which is why he was brought in to do this film. But that takes us straight into cast. So Jean Desjardins is George Valentin. I think for me, for what he was asked to do, I thought he did. I think he's got a charm and a certain charisma to him, which is all the more wow, makes me want to like know what it would have been like to see him, you know, give a full feature film while talking. Like, he's a good dancer, like the physical components he's good at. You know, the nightmare sequence when the cup hits the desk and the chair falls over and all those different things, like the fear that comes over his face, I feel like it's real. His sadness, depression is conveyed so well. Like, you really feel his pain. When he burns his house down, the anger and rage is great. When he finds out and sees that Pepe had purchased all his old stuff at the auction, like the look that comes over his face, and the almost like he's physically ill, and it leads to him wanting to kill himself. I will say, when I pulled up his filmography, he is in Wolf of Wall Street, But I really do remember him in Monuments Men, which isn't my favorite Damon George Clooney movie, but he's done a few, but just a shame that I didn't get to see more of him being this character. I don't remember him Wolf of Wall Street.
Do you not? Man, come on. He's the Swiss banker.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, yes.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, now...
I'm with you. I think he's a very talented actor, especially in the French films that he's been in from what I've read. And, you know, the two films I've seen him in, I loved him in The Wolf of Wall Street. But, like, if only I could hear his dialogue in this, I think it'd be perfect.
I feel that way for the lead actress, too, Berenice mm-hmm. Bejo or Bejo as Pepe Miller. It's funny. She's the actress who's gonna like be the breakout star for talkies, as they were called, yet she's the only one of the few people in the movie not to deliver audible dialogue. She seems very delightful. She was in Knight's Tale many years ago as the basically the servant to the woman that Heath Ledger falls in love with. I haven't seen her in anything else outside of that. I think she does, like, the chemistry between the two of them in that scene where he's dancing with her and he just can't get it together because of this attraction he feels for her. I feel that is genuine, and I buy her feelings for him. But it's the same thing, the scene where she walks in on him trying to kill himself. It's a passionate moment, and if only we could have seen that scene and heard that scene. It's just not the same. When you've grew up most of your life watching film one way and you've seen a few silent films, it's just hard to go, oh, that's great, because you're so used to the audible side.
She seems like a lovely actress and great potential leading lady for other films, so I hope she gets other work. But Luke, John Goodman, man, I'm a big John Goodman fan. He plays Al Zimmer in this, the studio head, I believe. And yeah, he's one of my favorite actors. I think he's supremely underrated. He has no Academy Award nominations in his career. And I think for a guy who's been in movies like The Big Lebowski, Flight, Argo, Coyote Ugly, I had to mention that one, Bringing Out the Dead, 10 Cloverfield Lane, and Raising Arizona, you'd think somewhere in there he would have nabbed one. And, you know, I love his recent work on the HBO comedy show with Danny McBride, The Righteous Gemstones. He's a very talented actor, and I think he's capable of immense range from comedy to very serious dramas.
It is, and I really loved him from Roseanne as a kid growing up.
That's how I think most people remember him.
I loved him in that, but yeah, like in Flight, as the when he first shows up there, man, you'll never have to buy a drink in this town ever again. It's just like, you know, he has something about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, right? Is he?
Yes, he's in a lot of Coen Brothers movies.
Like, I enjoy him. I enjoy him on screen. I've told you my theory before about him and Steve Buscemi, why they always get slighted.
You have.
I think it goes back to, unfortunately, I think it goes something about that he's not a Leonardo DiCaprio, so he doesn't get his, I think as once the current voters start to, you know, kind of edge out or pass away and we get hopefully he gets a different role where he can finally get his chance. The next guy has a nomination for a movie that just shocks me that it came from this, but James Cromwell's Clifton, the most loyal butler driver you'll ever meet in your life in this movie. But he's one of the most recognizable for me because he looks so much like my late grandfather, Kurt Shoemaker. It has a Best Supporting Actor nom in 1996 for Babe, of all movies. Recently, he's in one of our favorite shows, Succession. He just got a Primetime Emmy nomination for playing Uncle Ewan. Some of his best movies are recognizable for our listeners would be The Green Mile. Off the start would be one that's like, oh, yeah, he's the – I believe he's the warden, right?
He is the warden, yes.
W, he plays George H.W., L.A. Confidential, a movie we've brought up on here before. People versus Larry Flint, he's good in. And then for a Trekkie like me, he's in Star Trek First Contact. He's the scientist when they end up on Earth in a different time. Anyway, he's in that. And I think he usually kind of gives off like this kind of, he's a jerk, bad guy vibe. But in this, he's so loyal as his driver.
Thank you for reminding me he's Uncle Ewan in Succession.
Yeah. Like, even I think his nomination's for guest actor because he's only on like two episodes, but you love him when he does show up.
The most cynical, just miserable old man that you'll ever meet on that show.
Just two brothers that are miserable and hate each other, unlike any duo.
And polar opposite in, polar, yes, in personality.
Yeah.
What, Grandpa Grumps or Uncle Fun?
Shout out. So there's a scene, and it's right before George decides to basically go to kill himself. There's a cop that approaches him on the street, and it's the assistant coach from the show Coach. I think his name was Dauber. He plays that guy. I did not see that coming. I was like, is that the guy from Coach? And I had to look it up, and it was such an odd role. But, and then last on cast, shout out to Uggie the dog, recently passed away, but really steals the show on what they have him do in this movie. I loved me some of that dog. It reminds me of the dog from My Dog Skip, but just anytime it popped up, it was great.
Dogs in movies, especially when they're not vicious, you know, it's always great characters.
Yeah, like Sandlot, man. IMDb versus Rotten Tomatoes scores. I already have a feeling where you're going, but this is where we do our over or under. 7.9 on IMDb with 226,000 reviews. Tomato meter of 95. I'm not shocked there, but I'm really shocked. Audience score of 87. I'm imagining you're going to be in the 50s, 60s.
I'll give it a flat 70 all around, honestly, because I think it's a quality production. Like I said, I think the flaw in it that it wasn't just a period piece, black and white with dialogue.
Yeah, I'm a 75 range, because it is. I think it's wonderfully shot. When I know that they tried to mimic the style of how they shot movies from that era as much as they could, and you know, it is what it is. We got what we knew we were going into, I guess. We're on to Sell It to My Dad. Sell my dad on watching a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Absolutely. So, Marty, if you want to watch a true legend in cinema, you need to watch Charlie Chaplin. I'm going to recommend two movies. The movie Chaplin, starring Robert Downey Jr., which is a proper biopic. I would watch that first just because it's a proper biopic about his life. Robert Downey Jr. is fantastic in it. Anthony Hopkins is in it. It's just a great movie about this early 1920s actor from England who was really, he came from nothing, very poor guy, but he was unbelievably talented actor, and he was a silent film star, and he turned into directing and writing his own stuff as well, and just an absolute legend. So please, Marty, watch Chaplin, starring Robert Downey Jr., and you'll love it.
Yeah, and that's another film I think we saw from Frank Scheider. At least I remember watching it around that time.
That was, I think, the first movie from within the past 50 years he showed in my class that I had with him.
Oh, yeah. He showed us Trip to the Moon, which is like a 1905 short film that Smashing Pumpkins kind of put into one of their music videos later on. And for a 1905 silent film, it was unbelievable. Like, they use like the guy's face to be the center of the moon and all this stuff, and you think, man, how far we've come in film, but how brilliant was it they could do what they did then, so long ago.
You know, we talk about the guy a lot because he did show us some great stuff, and it helped our knowledge in film for sure.
I'm sending him a link to the cast right now. So, breaking down the movie, a plot synopsis as best I can. In 1927, silent film star George Valentin is posing for pictures outside the premiere of his latest hit film when a young woman, Peppy Miller, accidentally bumps into him. Valentine reacts with humor to the accident and shows off with Peppy for the cameras. The next day, Peppy finds herself on the front page of Variety with the headline, "Who's That Girl?" which is kind of a shock when they show it because George is, in fact, married. So to see this, it would probably put a little strain on your marriage to be front and center, but George blows it off. Later, though, Peppy capitalizes on the headline, auditioning as a dancer, and gets spotted by Valentine at the studio. And he insists that she have a part in his studio's next production, despite objections from the studio boss, Al Zimmer, played by John Goodman. While performing a scene in which they dance together, the two of them show great chemistry, despite her being merely an extra. With little guidance from Valentine, he kind of tells her to draw her beauty spot on her face and gives it to her. She's in his dressing room, which is kind of a creepy if you think that she's spying on, but she slowly rises through the industry, earning more and more prominent starring roles. 2 years later, though, Zimmer announces the end of production of silent films after showing Valentine a talkie or a movie with sound, and Valentine is dismissive, insisting that it's just a fad. This leads to a nightmare sequence where Valentine, he starts to hear the environment around him, and so do we. It's the first real sound effects we hear. But he himself cannot speak. Even his dog, he can hear bark. He decides he's going to produce and direct his own silent film using his entire fortune. Tears of Love is what he calls it, and he finances it. It opens on the same day as Peppy's new sound film, Beauty Spot. This is coupled with the 1929 stock market crash, so it leads to Valentine going bankrupt because everyone flocked to her film, did not go to his film, in fact, but she went to his film, and he's ruined. And his wife, who I just have to say, his wife's a terrible person. She kicks him out and leaves him solely because his movie didn't do well. So he moves in with his valet, chauffeur Clifton, with their dog. And while this happens, you get the opposite effect. Peppy goes on to become a huge star. Right here, if I stopped right here, had this all had dialogue, this is an incredible plot of showing the rise of one and the fall of another.
Absolutely. Paired with the fact that they are in love with each other. Like, I think one of them realizes it and the other one doesn't. Yeah, that's just all it's missing. Agreed on his wife. She bailed. She bailed as soon as she saw it was over for his career.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you're film bomb, so I'm done with you. Which, to her credit, he's not the best husband. There's the scene where she's like, why don't you just talk to me, George? And he just doesn't say anything. So later, you got the bankrupt Valentine. He auctions off all of his personal effects, even his prized mural that he loves so much with him and his dog, Uggy. He realizes, though, he hasn't paid Clifton in over a year, which, gosh, Clifton's the best. And so he gives him the car and he fires him. He says, go get another job. And Clifton's like, I don't want another job. And he says, go get another job. So a depressed and drunk Valentine angrily sets a match to his private collection of all of his earliest films. The nitrate film quickly blazes out of control, and he's overwhelmed by the smoke and passes out, still clutching a single canister. However, Uggy goes and gets a nearby cop, comes over, they rescue Valentine, he's hospitalized. He wakes up, however, in Peppy's house after she visited him in the hospital to find out that the only film canister that he kept was the scenes of them dancing together. And so he wakes up in that bed at her house, and Clifton now working for her. And, you know, he kind of seems dismissive and not necessarily buying into being helped out. He doesn't want the help. But, you know, Clifton's like, dude, this is your shot. Like, get over it. Peppy insists to Zimmer that Valentine co-star in her next film, threatening to quit the studio, which is a fun scene because she can't quite get it out. That basically, it's either, she says, it's one of us, pick one. He's like, I already did. She's like, I mean, I'm saying either you have us both or you have none of us. So, Clifton hands Valentine a script and he doesn't want to read it. But Valentine, once he gets on his feet, he discovers that Peppy purchased all of his auctioned effects, which just makes him even more miserable. And to the point where he's going to go attempt suicide. So he goes back to the wreckage or the burn up old home that he lived in, and he gets a gun out of a little box that was still somehow survived the fire. And, you know, he tries to shoot himself. And right as the gun, what you'd think goes off, you hear a huge bang, but it's not the gun. It's her crashing her car into a tree. And she runs inside, and there's just this moment where they realize we love each other and they embrace. And he's like, no one wants to hear me speak. And then she remembers that he's quite the dancer, and she persuades Zimmer to let them make a musical together. So now the audience hears sound for the second time as the film starts rolling. You get to hear the tap dancing occurring as they go through a great number, a perfectly choreographed number. They're heard panting after the number, and then finally you hear the director call cut. You get to hear John Goodman say, perfect, beautiful, could you give me just one more? And Valentine, his only audible line of the movie, replies in a French accent, with pleasure. The camera then pulls back to the sounds of the film crew as they prepare to shoot another take. End Zach's favorite movie.
By far that we've covered, yes.
Favorite scene. So for me, I love the nightmare sequence because to that point, you know, it looks very much like a traditional silent film. And he's looking in his mirror, quite like I'm looking at Zoom right now, and the cup goes down and you hear it. The chair squeaks, you hear laughter, the dog barking, and he is just going insane. But he tries to speak and nothing comes out. I think it's a great parable to what he's going through in his life. And I'll get in later how I thought they could have taken this exact moment and made it just a all-timer, and they went a different direction. I know you only have one, so go ahead and tell us yours.
I thought of two. So I do kind of enjoy the opening of the film, introducing him to the applause on the stage, to the sequence where he finally does meet Pepe, running into her, that little interaction. That I thought was well done.
Yeah, he's such a showboat, and he keeps stealing the applause from the lead actress. I want the suicide attempt because all everything that had led up to that moment, and when he finds that gun, he pulls it out, and he's really, I mean, I would imagine more so a ton of people that battle with depression go through this moment of, do I really want to end it? And he finally decides, I'm done. The dog's trying to, dog's basically trying to get him not to. And when you hear that bang, you think he's dead, he's done. And then you realize that she crashed her car, and then she figuratively and literally saves his life. And I think that's a powerful moment.
Absolutely. I realize they're in love. If only there was dialogue. My other one is, I love the ending dance, you know, number they performed together for Zimmer and the director, I assume. I thought that was not only great choreography and good tap dancing, but it just finally showed them together in love and being happy, really.
Oh, yeah. They rehearsed that scene for 5 months, practicing almost every day in the exact same studio that Debbie Reynolds and Gene Kelly used to rehearse for Singing in the Rain. Obviously, Singing in the Rain has great numbers all across the board, but yeah, a great way to send out the movie for sure. Favorite quotes, a little different for us this time around since there's only so many quotes that are actually spoken. I think you've got the word cut. You got perfect. You have about 10 words spoken in this film. So I had to choose quotes that show up when, you know, like classic silent film style, someone speaks and they show the written text, almost like closed caption. His wife says to him, I'm unhappy. And he responds with, so are millions of us, which is so true. If you really think about it, if you ever think, oh man, I'm down in the dumps, there's so many people battling depression or so many different things.
Absolutely.
I talked about the spoken lines when he says perfect, beautiful, and he says with pleasure. You know, I thought a good quote in it was George Valentine saying, I'm the one people come to see. They never needed to hear me, which I think arrogance might be his tragic flaw here. Obviously, he didn't wake up to the times. It's kind of like a movie you'll talk about later about you know, almost being a dinosaur and sticking with the same thing and not adapt or die, right?
Absolutely. And chose his, as a vanity. And that's really what led him to his suicide attempt and his fall from grace.
Which Peggy, that's my last one. When Peppy walks in and she basically says she bought it because she just wanted to help him, because she truly cares for him beyond just him giving her a big break. She loves him.
Yep. Definitely their chemistry was the best part of the movie, in my opinion.
Our score, done by Ludovic Bors, wins best original score this year. As far as for me, for what it added to the film, I think it adds everything, really. I mean, when you talk about a silent movie, you have to have a score. Like, the score that plays for him burning down his apartment is like, it's almost something I feel like Hans Zimmer would have thrown in. It's really well done.
Yeah, the music, what he assembled was excellent. I will give him that. And I do see how it won in a decent year of competition in that area.
Yeah. Casting cut, we do not have any for you this time around. The actor or the director had worked with both the leading people previously, and these were his go-tos. As far as Goodman and Cromwell, I can't speak to the process for them, but there were no other alternatives that we could find through our research. So, going straight into it, issues with the movie. Give it to us.
I think what kind of already have said it. For me, it has a great plot. It needed to be a black and white 1920s period piece with actual dialogue. And then I think you get a good movie that is still a Best Picture nominee and a classic black and white film that's addressing a great era, the silent film era's transition to talkies. That's a huge deal. And it was a crazy time. Honestly, Hollywood was insane from the 1920s to the 1950s, even 60s to a degree, as covered in parts of Godfather. You hear stories about it. And, just a wild, cutthroat industry. So if they portrayed a little more of that and with dialogue, I would have liked it more.
Yeah. Stylistically, they obviously, it took guts to think, hey, let's try to put this out here, but make it more of than just the part talkie, like what you just said. Here's my vision of the movie. If the plot was, as we progress through the movie, that slowly every one of the characters started to have audible dialogue except George, I think that's a hell of a story, because it kind of shows that the world around him's changing, but he's stuck in his world. And then as he finally comes out of that shell, we finally hear the "with pleasure." That would have made more sense. Like, I think for me, that's what holds this back. And I realize they were tempting to do and what all the guts it did took to do it. But the film makes its own point. No one wants silent film anymore. Like, they show that as part of the plot. Yet this is the movie. Well, yeah, none of us, that's not why we go to film anymore. James Cromwell, like I said, he stated that everyone spoke their lines. So is there a way, is that on the internet and subreddit or something where we can hear all those things? I think that would have been, I think it, like you, it would have been excellent. I can't think of a movie off the top of my head that covers that story, at least this deeply.
There's not one that I know of. It maybe way back in the day,
Chaplin shows his career.
Yeah, he still did.
I mean, he ended up transitioning into talkies.
So did, I was about to say, it wasn't the end of his career, that transition. I will give you a little future preview. You'll like this, Luke. This era is going to be covered coming up, hopefully whenever, production can resume safely. Damien Chazelle film, I think Emma Stone, Brad Pitt, Babylon, it's covering that era. I think Brad Pitt plays a silent film star who fails to make the transition to talkies, and Emma Stone is a actual talkies film star who was a real person and wild. Tobey Maguire is going to be in it. Leo turned it down, so it's still – I'm excited.
Giselle is great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, we're skipping Greatest Resume Edition this time for our listeners because we think it's this for, I mean, pretty much everyone except Goodman. So, I mean, we didn't really want to hash that out since he has such a minor role. So we're going to hop straight into, you know, the biggest part of this, the competition. So this year there was only 9 total nominees, counting the artist. Zach, give us one of your first movies from the competition.
I'm going to lead off, Luke, with another Alexander Payne film, The Descendants, starring George Clooney, Bo Bridges, Jeff Bridges' brother, Shailene Woodley, and Judy Greer. What a great movie. I really love it. Alexander Payne, he's a great writer-director that always brings original kind of family dramas with a lot of humor to them. So this movie's no exception. George Clooney plays a husband and dad of 2 young girls whose wife has suffered a traumatic brain injury from a boating accident. They live in Hawaii, and that's where it happened. And she's basically in a coma and on life support. And they're informed that she's not going to make it. And I'm not going to spoil it, but he finds out some things about their marriage that are pretty heartbreaking, you know. And but like I said, this movie, Alexander Payne always injects enough humor to where you're not just, you know, devastated in his films, even though you might cry in some of them. But there's plenty of humor in this, and I love it. It's a great, great movie. Do you have anything to add, Luke? I really adore
Clooney the Oscar.
I loved his performance in this. It's outside of Michael Clayton, it's up there for me. It really is.
Probably his best shot too, and Desjardins stole it from him.
Yeah, well, and kind of like if DDL doesn't do that movie, I think he wins for Michael Clayton as well. But yeah, so The Descendants, it was a nominee.
I've got Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Can I just say this? My least favorite movie to feature Tom Hanks. And he's got some, you know, Tom Hanks has a brilliant career. He's got some stinkers, but I think this wasn't my favorite. So it's a Stephen Daldry film. Same man that has appeared on our pod before. He's got 2 Best Director nominations, 1 for The Reader, 1 for The Hours. The movie has a really solid cast. It's got Tom Hanks. It's got Sandra Bullock. It's got Max von Sydow from Last Time, who I believe, doesn't he win for this film? He gets nominated. He doesn't win. And then it's got, you know, John Goodman. It's got Jeffrey Wright. It's another movie with a score done by Alexander Desplat. And it centers around this young boy named Oscar, who's played by Thomas Horn. And the boy, he's got Asperger's syndrome. And he lost his father in the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center. And he's absolutely convinced that his dad has left just a final message for him somewhere in the city, because they used to play these little games with clues and things. And he finds this key in his dad's closet, and he's going to go see what lock it fits. And, you know, he's starting – Sandra Bullock is really going through a tough time in her grieving process, and there's a disconnect between them. And, you know, he goes on this journey to kind of find what it's missing and find out what his dad maybe left him. And – you know, it's a heartbreaker. It's just like all 9/11 themed movies, but the story for me, it's not well written. And the best acting performance you get probably comes from Sydow, who helps the boy out. And you have a small little window where Tom Hanks wasn't crushing homers, and I think this is one of those years. It's a very forgettable performance by him. It's not a movie, if you say Tom Hanks, I don't think this is one of the first 10 movies people say. I wasn't a huge fan of it when it came out, and I couldn't even make it through the rewatch.
I've never seen it, and now I won't. Next film in the competition from this year is The Help, a movie I have seen. It's a Tate Taylor film with a pretty good cast. Jessica Chastain, who I adore, great actress. Viola Davis, another great actress. Bryce Dallas Howard, Ron Howard's daughter, good actress. Allison Janney, Octavia Spencer, and then the lovely, talented Emma Stone. You know, this movie, I don't think it's aged well, Luke. I don't think it's aged well at all, honestly. The name itself is not very, very good. It was a book, and I did not read the book. It was based on a book. And I mean, I'm sure it's taken from partially true stories or somewhat inspired by that time period, the, you know, Jim Crow, civil rights era South. In this case, I think it takes place in Georgia. It's been years since I've seen it, but it takes place Mississippi, excuse me, Jackson, Mississippi. And yeah, it's essentially about Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, who are the help in this case, helping hired by rich white families in Jackson. They work for them as maids. And then Emma Stone's, I think, college graduate who's home, you know, just came home as a reporter. And she goes on a crusade basically for these women to help get them, you know, basically a part of the civil rights movement type deal. And Jessica Chastain plays a sympathetic character to them. She's pretty lovely in this. And Emma Stone's good as well. You know, everyone's good in it. It's just not my favorite.
I read the book when I was, gosh, I think we had to read it in either like pre-AP English.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe even in eighth grade. We read that and Secret Life of Bees back to back. I'm actually more partial to Secret Life of Bees, I think, than this book. But I can understand that the name alone doesn't really help, nor does the fact that it's an ex cotton plantation, if I remember correctly. So it's almost like surveying indentured servitude. And, you know, that's not anything I don't think any of our listeners would agree is a good subject matter. The next movie, I have The Tree of Life. And if you want to watch a movie with one of the most unique opening sequences ever in the history of film, this might be it. It rivals like the very lovely Nocturnal Animals opening and 2001, A Space Odyssey. So, and this movie, it's shot by one of Zach's favorite directors of photography, Emmanuel Lubezki, who after this year, a couple years after this, is about to go on a tear where he goes like three in a row for cinematography, gets his fifth cinematography nom for this film that stars Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, and Jessica Chastain. All three give top-notch performances. It's another Des Platt score. That guy just shows up all the time. And his score in the opening, Big Bang opening sequence that shows like the start of life and how we get, which is an interesting take to get to, you know, the title, Tree of Life. His score there is unbelievable. And the story centers around Jack, and I have to go ahead and preface that the story flashes back and forth between young Jack and older Jack, and older Jack, adult Jack's played by Sean Penn, and they're three brothers, and they're growing up in this small town, Texas, the O'Brien family, and Jack, he and his father have this very conflicted relationship. But his father's played by Brad Pitt, but he and his mother have just this incredible relationship. And the mother's played by Chastain. And when we get to the adult version of Jack with Sean Penn, he struggles with his past and he tries to make sense of his whole childhood while also grappling. He's got other issues in his life. And, you know, it's a watch that is really great to dive into, as far as like growing into an adult and reflecting on family and how you were raised, maybe how you want to raise your kids. And first time I watched this, the opening kind of turned me off because I just wasn't expecting anything like that. But when I watched it again, I loved it. And I think it's an oft forgotten Sean Penn role, but it's a good one. And Brad Pitt had a hell of a year between this and Moneyball, which you'll talk about later. It's a very interesting movie with, like I said, I would say it's the most unique opener of all time.
It's one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen, and Terrence Malick is like that, but I do like this movie. It's not my favorite of his. I like Thin Red Line more, but the performances in this movie, like you mentioned, are outstanding. My next movie, Luke, you mentioned Tom Hanks's worst movie in your mind. This is Steven Spielberg's worst movie in my mind, War Horse. Steven Spielberg movie was nominated for this year, and I'm just not a fan. It's about a horse from Britain that basically goes through various owners that are soldiers during World War One, and all the horror that, you know, the horse experiences and sees around him, which, you know, World War One, if you've seen 1917 or if you've studied history of that time, is awful, you know, absolute travesty, a lot of loss of life. And, you know, this movie kind of shows that, and it's Spielberg's usual band with, you know, Kaminsky behind the camera and John Williams, a good John Williams score, I will say that. The music's good, but this movie just didn't do it for me, Luke. I did not like it at all.
Now, you know, maybe the horse thing's been done too often, right?
Yeah, I think that was it. I mean, it's fine. A good Western, obviously, horses are somewhat of characters, but they don't – it's hard to make a movie just about a horse outside of Seabiscuit, in my mind.
Yeah. I wasn't even a huge fan of, like, Hidalgo. I mean, so, you know, take it for what it is. Next up for competition, I'm going to go with Hugo. And just this guy never stopped showing up in our pods. Hello again to Martin Scorsese. I would call this the most unique movie of his career, very outside his norm. He partners with writer John Logan, who adapted the script from The Invention of Hugo Cabret, which is the main character. For our listeners, you may remember John Logan from our Gladiator pod, but he also wrote The Aviator, Sweeney Todd, Skyfall. And this film is completely shot in 3D. And the great Robert Richardson wins for cinematography because of how visually stunning this is. And, you know, just a lot goes into shooting a movie with this style. Like, the decision to shoot this way, I think, probably was a game changer for our listeners. Shooting 3D, it basically means that you've got two cameras focus in this certain area, and then you fuse the shots together to give more. Anyway, it takes a lot to do that. And the budget for this movie was $170 million, which, I mean, that ranks in the upper echelon of budgets. But that gives you an idea of the process. And the cast for this, very unique cast. So you've got Asa Butterfield, which is the star of Sex Education on Netflix, which is a show Zach and I love. There's Ben Kingsley, Sacha Baron Cohen, Chloe Grace Moretz, and Jude Law. And anyway, Butterfield plays this orphan who's alone. He's got his uncle, and Hugo is played by Asa Butterfield, and he lives in the walls of this train station, and it's like the 1930s in Paris. And Hugo's job is to basically maintain the clocks in the station. But to him, the most important task is to protect a broken, automated, like, and this notebook left to him by, he's got this ottoman and he's got this notebook. And, you know, his late father was played by Jude Law, and there's some scenes of that. You know, there's this merchant played by Ben Kingsley, and he's got a goddaughter who's played by Chloe Grace Moretz. And essentially the two of them go on this quest to solve the mystery of what happened to the ottoman. And he really just wants to find a home. Really a fun watch, incredible blend of stunning 3D work, fantastic sound editing in it. It's a real fun Sacha Baron Cohen, very unlike other movies that he's done. The editing really puts you in the movie, and it's kind of a brilliant story. I mean, there's a reason it got so many nominations, but it's very, like, for Scorsese, it's one of the most unique, and I don't think he'll ever do anything like this again.
Yeah, I agree with you. Extremely unique movie for him, out of his ballpark, that is brilliant, as you said. That was a brilliant way to describe it. My final movie of the competition of the nominees for this year is Moneyball, the brilliant Bennett Miller film starring Brad Pitt, as Luke mentioned, in the role as Billy Bean, the real-life GM, general manager of the Oakland Athletics. And Moneyball is based on a book, and it's a true story about Billy and the Oakland A's in the 2002 season. Billy hires a guy named Paul DePodesta from the Cleveland Indians, and Paul really has this kind of cutting edge new way of scouting the players and also analyzing the game, and it's basically cybermetrics. It's kind of the beginning of that, if I'm not mistaken, and basically an analytics approach to baseball scouting and also managing your team. And Billy buys into it completely because the Oakland A's, if you know anything about baseball, there's no salary cap. Teams can spend as much money as they want on players. So that's why teams like the Yankees, you know, Dodgers, Red Sox, teams like that, they spend a lot of money, and sometimes they win, sometimes they don't. But the Oakland A's do not have that luxury, and Billy realized that. So that's why he hired Paul, played by Jonah Hill, who is, you know, Jonah and Brad get acting noms for this movie. They're brilliant together. They have great chemistry, as we talked about before. Great, very dynamic. It's got a great cast. You know, you get Chris Pratt playing Scott Hatterberg. It's basically they hired actors to play these real life baseball players from this season. And, you know, I don't want to spoil how it went, how the season went, but the movie itself, it's outstanding for a baseball movie. It's really unlike anything I've ever seen. It analyzes the game in a very cool way without, you know, getting too obsessive, or, you know, for your average baseball fan, you're not going to be overwhelmed basically by the approach they take with this movie, which is what I loved about it, because I do love baseball, but I'm not a diehard. But this movie, it's brilliant. And the relationship between him and his daughter when she's singing on the guitar, I love that. I don't have a daughter, I don't have kids, but you know, that about brought tears to my eyes.
Let me know if you change your mind and stay in California. If not, you're a really great dad.
I'm just a little bit caught in the middle. Life is a maze and love is a riddle. I don't know where to go, can't do it alone. I've tried and I don't know why. Slow it down, make it stop, or else my heart is going to pop. Cause it's
and brings tears to his at the end.
It does. The end when she sings both times, dude, I about cried both times. It's just such, and that it's for a baseball movie, you'd go, what? You were crying almost. Like, it's so good. It's just so good. So well done. Wally Fizer, the great Chris Nolan cinematographer, he does this film for him, a rare movie where he's not doing it for Chris Nolan, for Bennett Miller. And it's great. Outstanding performances. The late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman is Art Howe, the manager. So I haven't named everybody, but please check it out if you haven't seen it. Moneyball.
It was probably my favorite book of my, you know, high school years all the way into a lot of college. And in fact, Michael Lewis has written several books that they've turned into movies that have been great movies. Like, I mean, he's definitely Moneyball and Big Short are great ones. I even like his book Flash Boys that has to do with trading in them. Anyway, if Michael Lewis writes it, odds are they eventually might adapt it into a movie. Great movie, great concept, game changer for baseball. Everything you just said, nail on the head. My last one, Midnight in Paris. Woody Allen's finest, just sensational. You want a feel-good movie with a fun cast, this is the one. Like I said, written and directed by Woody Allen. The film stars, I'm just throwing out a ton of names here. Kathy Bates, Adrian Brody, Corey Stoll, Marion Cotillard, Rachel McAdams, Michael Sheehan. Oh, and of course, Owen Wilson is Gil Pender. Owen Wilson is this screenwriter and aspiring novelist, and he's vacationing in Paris with his fiance, who's played by Rachel McAdams. And he's really taken to touring the city alone. And on one such night, you know, he encounters a group of strange yet familiar people. And he gets picked up at the stroke of midnight in a Model T car, basically. And he's basically time travels to another era, to an era that he always wished he'd live in. You know, like the jazz era, the era of icons of art and literature. You have so many, you know, you have people from F. Scott Fitzgerald to Salvador Dali, to Ernest Hemingway, to Gertrude Stein. If you name someone around that 20s, 30s era, he's taken back to this time period. But the more time he spends with these heroes and people he adores, the more he realizes that he might suffer from golden age syndrome, which is alluded to in the movie, where one just grows bored with the present and thinks a previous time was a better era and one they wanted to live in. This, of course, is a fantasy romantic comedy, but I think by far it's the best original story of the year. Like, the whole concept is crazy to me, especially when you get into him falling in love with Cotillard and her also experienced the same thing and wanting to travel to a previous time period. And then, you know, those guys that they meet in that time period think they're Renaissance, and it just keeps showing the same pattern developing. Just great scenes from the City of Lights too. The opening 2 minutes, like classic Woody Allen style, show the different parts of the city as a music plays and the credits show. On a rewatchability scale, it's a 9 out of 10, maybe a 10 out of 10. And I think my favorite part on rewatch is at the end, he walks out of the Shakespeare and Company bookstore and he walks by a restaurant. And that exact restaurant and an exact table he walks by is exactly where my wife and I, Chelsea, had lunch in Paris one summer ago. And I just was like, God, I didn't even remember this movie when I was here. It's just a delight. If you haven't seen this, I know Woody Allen, he is what he is, as far outside of film. We all know the different controversies about that. But for this movie, it's my favorite Owen Wilson, and it's just so fun to watch. I love watching it again. I'm glad that you showed it to us in college all those years ago.
It's Woody Allen's best movie, and yeah, like you said, it's an absolute joy to watch. It's so well done and makes you want to visit Paris, and I'm glad you visited that same spot. That's awesome. We are to the snubs though, my friend. This is exciting because we have a few good ones. If you want to lead us off.
Yeah, sure. I'll go right in, you know, talking about my guy here, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Fincher. He's back. I mean, we just talked about Social Network. What a movie I think this is. I just, directed by him, written by Steven Zaillian, most known for Schindler's List, which we've discussed already on this pod, but he also worked with Sorkin on the Moneyball script. And he, of course, has done The Irishman, Gangs of New York, been a part of those teams. And this is an adaptation of the 2005 novel with the same name. And here's what's crazy to me. The film itself, it was chosen by the National Board of Review as one of its top 10 films of the year. The American Film Institute chose it as its one of its top 10 films of the year. It receives 5 nominations this year. It wins for Best Film Editing. And it's not a Best Picture nominee. The movie stars Daniel Craig, Rooney Mara, Christopher Plummer, Stellan Skarsgård, who is a freak in it, and even Robin Wright is in, which I think she's also in Moneyball, plays Bean's wife. You know, Mara receives a nomination for Best Actress in this movie, and I think this is one of the most, it's a perfect psychological thriller. It's a lot like Zodiac in that way of mind-bending. It brings in over $230 million, and the story centers around, so you've got this financial reporter, Mikhail Blomkvist, played by Craig's character, and he finds a chance to kind of redeem himself when he's hired by this wealthy Swedish industrialist named Henrik Vanger. And that's Christopher Plummer's character. And he's trying to solve this 40-year-old murder of Vanger's niece, Harriet. And he believes that she was murdered by someone from the family. So eventually, Rudy Mara's character, Lisbeth, teams up. And she's a very different person, hard to work with, but very brilliant. And she's a genius. But she's got some trust issues. And like I said, it's gripping, it's interesting, entertaining, fantastic watch. So shocked that it wasn't nominated. And especially since they only stuck at 9 and they could have gone to 10 and you left this out. You had an opening for a movie and they leave it on the bench. I've read a lot of people argue that what held it back was that there was a Swedish adaptation that had already came out 2 years previously. And if that's the case of why they kept it out, shame on the Academy.
I watched it recently and I was impressed. You know, like you said, it's another Fincher, you know, just showing off, perfect movie from every aspect, editing, performances, you name it. My snub, I got to lead off strong, Drive, the Nicholas Winding Refn film. I believe he's Swedish or Danish, one of the two, director. I've got a lot of crazy stories about this movie, and the movie's crazy too, so there you go. This movie's great, though. It's very original. It stars Ryan Gosling, Bryan Cranston, Albert Brooks of Finding Nemo fame. You get Ron Perlman, who's fantastic as well, and then Carey Mulligan and Oscar Isaac and Christina Hendricks. I think I named everybody. So big, big cast, all excellent in their roles. It's if you know anything about Nicholas Winding Refn, if you've seen any of his stuff, he's into violence, and this movie is no exception. It's very violent at times, but the concept for it is genius. The plot is genius, and I really don't want to ruin it, but basically Ryan Gosling plays a hero character of sorts who's, you know, very talented driver and very talented at other things as well when it comes to protecting himself and others, and it just has a very unique concept with very little dialogue. It's not a lot of dialogue in this movie, and that's kind of a Nicholas Winding Refn staple. And you know, he moved over to LA to make this movie, and he rewrote the script, and he was, you know, interviewing actors, trying to audition them, and apparently Ryan Gosling was his first choice, and he didn't have a driver's license, which is also crazy. You know, well, that makes sense. You know, he's not going to have an American driver, but he doesn't have a driver's license at all, even in his home country. So Gosling was driving him home and an REO Speedwagon song came on and he just started singing along to it and bawling, the director this is. And he tells Gosling, like, the movie is essentially about a guy who drives around at night listening to pop songs, which is true in a lot of ways. And that sold Gosling. That made him want to make the movie. And then apparently he lived with Carey Mulligan in LA he got a house and he demanded the cast and as much of the crew as possible live with them while they make the movie, and a lot of them did. So very unique guy. I think he's very talented. I've told Luke about this Amazon Prime TV series he came out with this past year that I watched during quarantine. That's the craziest thing I've ever seen. But this movie, honestly, it's his best work. It's excellent. It's very well shot. Great performances. You know, it's honestly an original LA crime tale. Kind of, it's a noir in a way, but it also kind of plays with a couple genres, because it's like I've mentioned before about some movies, for one act, it's one thing, and then very quickly it shifts into another thing. So Drive.
Yeah. Like I said, though, I think the first time I ever watched it, I just wasn't real focused in on it. I think I was working on other things, but, this time watching it, I was like, gosh, dang. I think why it got knocked is maybe not an Academy movie is because it's of a lot of the action sequences, but all the scenes in between, like, I'm just going to say, when he curb stomps and beats the heck out of those dudes and kills them, it's like, oh my gosh, where did that come from? He's like, his whole character of who he's portraying is great. And Mulligan's really good. I thought she had a real under, and even the little Oscar Isaac you get's great. Great movie. I'm glad I rewatched it. My last, or I guess I have two more. So I'll go with, I'll talk about Margin Call, an underrated film for this year. I think it was probably released too soon. What I mean by too soon is that it covers the housing market crash kind of in a way that The Big Short did, but just so close to when it actually happened. And I don't think people are really ready to watch some of that stuff. You know, by the time The Big Short got there, you'd had some people, you know, you'd kind of had a little bit of a rebound. This movie was directed by J.C. Chandor, who does Most Violent Year, which I know we'll talk about later on. Another Oscar Isaac performance. He does Triple Frontier. This is an all-in-one day film, which you don't get a ton of those anymore. And it centers around, there's this big financial company, almost like some of the ones you see in Big Short. And they're downsizing. And one of their victims of the downsizing is a risk management division head who's played, I think, by Stanley Tucci, who is working on this huge analysis just when he was let go. And his protege completes this whole study late in the night, and then he realizes, oh my gosh, what he discovered was that the crash was about to happen. And what follows is this long night of like double checking and double dealings between senior management and all the way up to the CEOs. They prepare to do whatever they can to mitigate some of the disaster and risk that's going to happen. And, you know, it dives into unethical practices and what they're dealing with. And it's got Kevin Spacey, Paul Bettany, Jeremy Irons, Zachary Quinto, Penn Bagley, Simon Baker, Demi Moore, Stanley Tucci, just a really great cast. It's one of the best retellings of how that crash affected basically people, like employees, because they do this ending shot of just, you know, kind of everything emptied out in on their different trading floors, and just a crushing blow to our economy for a few years. It was cast really well as far as like who plays a certain roles. Like Irons as the CEO is perfect. Like I couldn't think of anyone else better to play because of how he is and how he sounds as an actor. And then Spacey's this mid-level manager who's kind of a jerk. And then Quinto and Badgley, if from You, correct? He's the guy from You. Mm-hmm. They're great in it. Like, they're the ones who figure it all out. But at the same time, just how they play almost like they're mid-level guys. They're not real important in the company, but how they talk to the higher-up people is just – it's a fun movie. It's a great movie, I think.
I have it on my Amazon Prime to watch. I was a big J.C. Chandor fan after watching A Most Violent Year, which you suggested to me, which left Netflix, which sucks. My next snub is Bridesmaids. I think it's only proper to mention this movie as a snub because on the surface, it's a comedy movie, but it's really a lot more. I mean, yes, it's hilarious throughout, but what you get is a great Paul Feig. Wig, however you say his last, it's a weird last name, Paul Feig movie. And the main character is essentially a bridesmaid at her best friend's wedding, and all the hilarity that ensues from that as she's struggling in her current position in life and also struggling to find love of her own. And yeah, it's brilliant. You get a lot of great actresses in it. Melissa McCarthy, I think, gets nominated by the Academy for this movie, which is very rare for a comedy role since Tropic Thunder. Robert Downey Jr. is the last time I can think of that happening. And yeah, it's just outstanding. It's funny. It's original in every way. What's her name? The title care, Kristen Wiig, she's hilarious. I am a big fan of her. And then Paul Thomas Anderson's wife is her best friend, Maya Rudolph. So a very funny movie with a lot of heart in it as well.
It's It's an all, like, I don't know of a time I've watched it and not laughed. I know that my wife loves it too. It's hilarious. It really is hilarious. All of those ladies, anytime they've come up in anything else, they're funny. Like, it's a, like you said, it's an all timer. It's a movie out there. Anyone that's listening, I know if you watch it, you're going to laugh. There won't be, there's no way you make the whole movie not go, this is funny. My last snub here, and it's one that I've loved for just a long time, ever since it came out, and it's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And it's done by Swedish director Tomas Alfredson. And he brings this Cold War spy thriller to the screen based on a novel of the same name. And it's got an all-star cast of Englishmen. You've got Gary Oldman. You have Benedict Cumberbatch. You have Colin Firth from The King's Speech. You have Stephen Graham, Tom Hardy, Ciarán Hinds, Toby Jones, Mark Strong. I mean, there's so many people in this movie. And I think Oldman gives one of his best performances of his career, which is really saying something considering the man. The movie really sucks you into this espionage very early on and has great dialogue sequences. It's based upon the novel I discussed, and it's around 1970s in England. And the head of MI6 Control is played by John Hurt, who does a fantastic job in it. And he gets an agent played by Mark Strong. He's going to meet with a Hungarian general who knows the identity of a Soviet spy within the organization's ranks. However, the mission goes wrong, and you know the general dies before he can reveal the information. And then all of a sudden, you get him's Control forced out. You get Gary Oldman's character, George Smiley, forced out, but he's called back to kind of find a mole within the top British ranks. And they're trying to get these Russian secret. And it's a great depiction of the Cold War, but as great as The Departed is at doing the whole mole thing, I may like this even better in that regard, because you literally do not know who the mole is until Oldman figures it out. Like in The Departed, you know the whole time who the different moles are. I mean, I'm not saying this movie's better than The Departed, but in the mole regards, like the reveal here is it's the best reveal as far as the mole part goes.
You didn't catch any hints, really?
Well, I mean, you get it at the point when they – I'm talking about when he's pulling out the chess pieces. He's going Tinker, Taylor, Soldier, Spy. At that point in the movie when he's talking to – I think he's talking to Hardy's character.
Mark Strong.
When he's talking to him about, you know, how did he know about Taylor or whatever, that's when you get a kind of an idea. But when he first gives all the code names, at that point, I'm like, that could be any one of those dudes. I mean, most of the time, I want it to be Toby Jones' character because I hate him in the movie.
Yeah, I know. Well, everyone in Control's inner circle besides Smiley pretty much sucked.
Oh, yeah.
But fantastic movie. Hoyte von Hema, Nolan's new cinematographer, shot it. It's delightful. One of the best, most original spy movies you'll ever watch. Love that movie. And like you, I just got to say, you mentioned watching In the Bedroom back to back to back. I watched this movie maybe 5 times in a row in a week. Like that, I was obsessed with it when it was on Netflix originally. My last snub is Shame. It's a Steve McQueen film, director of 12 Years a Slave. He also wrote this movie, co-wrote it. It stars Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan. And basically, Michael Fassbender is a rich New York City bachelor executive with a sex addiction. And this is a messed up – yeah, it's a very messed up movie in a lot of ways. But it's brilliant. I mean, it's brilliantly shot. You get one of Fassbender's best performances. Mulligan plays his sister in a very disturbing performance. Their relationship's something else. And it's just a great, great movie. Obviously it's warning, a lot of sexual content in this movie, but yeah, that's not entirely the point. Obviously the point is this Fassbender struggle obviously with his sex addiction, but also with his relationship with his sister and with his family to an extent, and also figuring out how to be happy in his own life and have a stable, you know, romantic relationship is kind of his goal.
That movie, God, I forgot that movie had came out this year. Just from the opening scene, you're like, is he? Oh, he is. And he seems so saddened that he just did that. And talk about a rough on the psychological side for sure. It's a good one. Like, I think I'm about to show that in the reflection of my 10. Give us your 10 first. Who would you have nominated?
All right, Luke. My 10 for this year, and I really didn't keep many from the Academy's original 9. I was not impressed. This was a weak year for film, but I came up with Moneyball, Drive, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. I did include Shame, The Descendants, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Fincher Strikes Again, Midnight in Paris, just easily the happiest, the happiest movie of this group. Tree of Life, I did keep because I think it is a cinematic marvel in a lot of ways. Bridesmaids, I do think that's best picture worthy as a comedy, and it's not the only comedy I would nominate for best picture in history, but it's outstanding. I think it's worthy. And my last is Hugo. I think Scorsese, what he did with that movie, I think it's worthy of all its nominations.
Man, so for our listeners, as we've discussed before, Zach and I don't share we throw them onto our doc as we do this segment. So we never know who each other picked. And I think I'm correct in saying this, you and I have the exact same 10.
We do. This is maybe the third time this has ever happened on the pod.
But that was normally with 5. We've never done it. No. I mean, I would have thought we'd swing and miss on 10, but we hit all 10 the same.
Well, like I said, weak year for film kind of made it really easier for us.
It was a weak year for film indeed.
Here's the real moment, though.
That brings us to, as weak as it was hard. I went so back and forth. Zach, who deserved the award?
I went with Moneyball, Luke.
38 home runs, 120 RBIs, and 47 doubles to replace.
The problem we're trying to solve is that there are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap, and then there's us. It's an unfair game.
And it was hard. I was stuck between Moneyball. I was stuck between Tinker Tailor. It kind of came on late. And then I was stuck between Drive. I thought Drive was really accomplished something original. But Moneyball, to me, kind of like I said, what Bennett Miller accomplished, that movie, you know, being – it's such an original take on baseball, and it is a true story, but how they shot it and how they present the story, it's just so cool. And I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a movie about masculinity too, because you have certain players in Beam to an extent who have been emasculated, whether they've been injured in their career like Hattieburg, or they've lost some skill. And it's, you know, kind of about them regaining their sense of purpose. And I just, I love it. And like I said, his daughter, those two scenes kind of made the movie for me. It brought it full circle to the point that this isn't just a baseball movie. It's about more than that, even though the subject is baseball. And I think it's a beautiful thing they accomplish.
Zach, if any other team wins the World Series, good for them. They're drinking champagne. They get a ring. But if we win on our budget with this team, we'll have changed the game. That's what I want. I want it to mean something. Love that quote. Love that movie. But I didn't go with it. All right? I couldn't go with it. It's the first time ever, I think, in my life that if I hadn't read the book first, I actually very rarely I'm like the book I love so much more because of some of the little intricacies. But if you do the whole book, it wouldn't have made a great movie. But I think what hurts the movie is the fact that they had any spoiler alert about what happens to their season. That's the one thing for me. It's like, I wish they would have, you know, came out on top. But still, it was my number two, making my number one. And this is going to throw you off, but no subject is terrible if the story is true, if the prose is clean and honest, and it affirms courage and grace under pressure. This is a quote by Ernest Hemingway in Midnight in Paris.
No subject is terrible if the story is true, if the prose is clean and honest, and if it affirms courage and grace under pressure.
Would you read it?
Your novel.
Yeah, it's like 400 pages long, and I'm just looking just for, you know, just an opinion.
My opinion is I hate it.
I mean, you haven't even read it.
If it's bad, I'll hate it because I hate bad writing. If it's good, I'll be envious and hate it all the more. You don't want the opinion of another writer. Writers are competitive.
I'm not going to be competitive with you.
You're too self-effacing. It's not manly. If you're a writer, declare yourself the best writer. But you're not as long as I'm around, unless you want to put the gloves on and settle it.
The pattern, true or form to me, very unique storytelling. And I think this is like it's a great vision of the City of Lights, all the shots you get of Paris. But I think really just, I think it's a really cool story about, you know, you get time travel in movies, but this version of it's so unique. In throwing in just all of these classical icons and art and literature. I mean, you got Pablo Picasso, you have Hemingway, you have all the people, different people I've talked about, the Fitzgeralds, you have T.S. Eliot, just throwing them all in. And you get that, it's almost like Owen Wilson's playing Woody Allen. I get that vibe from him in it. And just how he interacts with Rachel McAdams and how big of a jerk Michael Sheen is. And even Corey Stahl as Hemingway is so incredible. Like the scene where he gets in the car with him and he's just telling about a war story out of nowhere. You're just like, what is going on? It's I don't know. It's a movie I think I could rewatch over and over and over again. I was torn between this, Tinker Tailor, and Moneyball. But ultimately, this is another movie I would have never watched had you not recommended it. And it's my favorite Owen Wilson and it's my favorite Woody Allen. And that guy's been involved in so many great movies. And for as far as romantic comedies go, I recommend this to literally anyone. In fact, I may even put this on in front of Chelsea and I have a feeling that even she would like it. Midnight in Paris.
Chelsea would definitely love this movie. I am a little surprised, but what a great choice you made with Midnight in Paris. You've said everything brilliant about it, that it's just so perfect, such a fun, like it makes you feel good and it takes you through all these people in history that are beyond interesting, and they're played up in the most brilliant way by an ensemble cast. So I love that pick, Luke.
That takes us to the end here. Next time on And the Award Goes to, Zach and I will be breaking down the 85th Academy Award winner for Best Picture, Argo. We've discussed Ben Affleck before on this pod. Now we get to actually hash out one of his films. So we're looking forward to that. I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
And this was And the Award Goes to...